Welcome to Marvelous Disney, the podcast that discusses the most recent doings at one of the more dynamic divisions of the Walt Disney Company, which is, of course, Marvel Entertainment. This is entertainment writer Jim Hill, and my co-host, the amazing Aaron Adams, and I are recording this week's episode on Wednesday, December 15th, 2021. Just 10 days till Christmas. Though, Aaron, you just came across something that would be a really cool gift, I guess, for Christmas.
For me.
Yeah, well,
for me. I don't care when you get it for me. I'm not going to say Christmas next year. I don't want to wait that long, Jim.
Okay, well, you explain what it is I'm supposed to be chasing down for you.
All right, well, it does come out August of next year, so it is closer to a Christmas time present for next year than anything else. But Alex Ross, my very favorite artist for Marvel, is writing and doing artwork for a graphic novel called Fantastic Four Full Circle. A couple of things of note about this particular project. It will be an oversized graphic novel that will showcase Alex's beautiful artwork. Hooray for that. Mm-hmm. Alex is excited because it will also showcase his experimental new art style, which I'll be looking forward to seeing what his experimental new art style is all about. And then finally, it's a retelling of the origin of the Fantastic Four, but he said he's been wanting to tell this particular version of the story for many, many years, maybe even a decade or two, and now he's got the opportunity to both write and do the artwork for. So this is all him, baby. It's all coming out of his brain, and I can't wait. I'm very, very excited for that.
Cool. All right. Well, no, I'll tell you what. I'll get us two copies, because okay, this sounds like something I want as well. You were also mentioning as we were pre-gaming that it looks like unless somebody manages to make a deal, a lot of YouTube fans are going to get coal in their stocking, right? Thanks to the Walt Disney Company.
Yeah, and this seems more like a ploy that happens every year. Your local news channel, or, you know, like an ABC or a Fox or a CBS, doesn't matter. They all do it. Mm-hmm. They'll say, we have not yet come to terms with Dish for the 2023 year, and you could be losing our wonderful channel and all of its elaborate services that you rely on every single day. So unless you call Dish and yell at them and say, you need whatever this channel is that's begging for your support, you could lose us forever. And that's really just not the case. And so YouTube is now the one touting the sky is falling message. Mm-hmm. And what they're about to lose is ESPN, FX, ABC. Jim, you know who the owner of these companies are, right?
It rings a very vague bell. I want to say a rodent is involved somehow.
Absolutely, yeah. Up to 26 channels could be taken off of the YouTube TV streaming service if they do not come to terms with Disney on negotiating a new price. Now, I'm certain Disney would like more money for their product that they're offering, and YouTube would like to pay less money to keep the product online. And by putting out this message, they're hoping, they're praying that you, the loyal consumer, will go to Disney and say, how dare you? I need to have Disney things viewable on YouTube. When really, you could just go sign up for, and matter of fact, I just did renew not just Disney Plus this year, but I got the triple, the trifecta, the Hulu Plus, the Disney Plus, and the ESPN Plus for the discounted rate. And yes, I mean, you don't have to go to YouTube to get your Disney content. You can tap it straight from the tree, get the syrup straight from the maple there, if you wanted to.
If you wanted to. Okay. You know, I spend a surprising amount of time on YouTube these days.
Do you have Disney Plus? And if you do you have it through Disney or do you have it through YouTube?
Actually, I have it through Disney. In fact, I think we got it through D23. They had some amazing deal where if you signed up before the launch, you got like 3 years for this ridiculously low fee. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
You're covered for a couple more years before YouTube can lord that over your head.
This is true. This is true.
Okay.
But on the other hand, when you saw, and by the way, folks, want to stress this right up front, second half of today's show, Aaron and I will be talking about Hawkeye Episode 5. And while neither of us have managed to actually see Spider-Man No Way Home, hell, the Thursday evening preview screenings don't even begin till tomorrow, and it then officially opens in 4,325 theaters across North America. That's just kind of startling, that many theaters, you know, during this time when we're seeing, you know, the pandemic surge.
I don't think there's a lot of competition for screen time right now, so they could, they're airing it. I saw an old lady hanging up white sheets, and they're getting ready to project it onto those later on today.
There we go. There we go. Well, all right. I'm just going to warn you folks that we are, in fact, going to be talking about this on the second half of the show. So if you don't, you know, and there will be some spoilers. So if you want to go into this John Watts film clean, or for that matter, if you're behind on your episodes of Hawkeye, just tread lightly into the second half of the show today. But when you mentioned while we were pre-gaming that you've already seen the two end scenes from No Way Home, did you see those on YouTube?
I will not say where I got my contraband, my illicit material, my stolen goods. That would just be wrong to give up your source.
I stand corrected.
And by the time I got done playing it, there was when you go to hit replay and watch it again, there was already a copyright notice. This has been taken down to copyright holder said, hey, that's mine. Take that off.
Oh, wow.
So, you had to be quick on the ball today with that one.
Okay. So that was the equivalent of a Disney whack-a-mole.
That exactly was what they were playing today. Yeah. A different rodent that they were having problems with.
There we go. All right. Well, before we head into the news segment, the news portion of Marvelous Disney is brought to you by Storybook Destination, trusted travel partner of the Jim Hill Media Podcast Network. For a worry-free travel experience, please book online at storybookdestinations.com. Okay, so Spider-Man No Way Home had its Hollywood premiere on Monday, December 13th. By the way, Drew Taylor, who I do fine-tuning with, has seen this film and really enjoyed it. Talked about the big emotions and surprising turns and that sort of thing. And reviews are already bubbling up. Most of them were posted today. They're largely positive. Film currently has a 94% freshness rating over Rotten Tomatoes. Current financial projections suggest that this Paramount Pictures release will sell over its opening weekend 130 million worth of tickets in North America, an additional 160 million overseas, for a projected worldwide gross over its opening weekend of $290 million. Which, given that Spider-Man No Way Home has a running time of 2 hours and 28 minutes, is impressive in and of itself. And I think on the last show, we talked about when the tickets went on sale that Fandango crashed and, you know, that there's huge demand for this. And you and I had previously talked about how Spider-Man No Way Home had been marketed. And we talked at length at the battles that supposedly Sony's PR department and Disney's PR department was having, and how Marvel Studio was basically trying to referee. In the end, the fact that they were able to keep so much off screen, so to speak, by cutting together a trailer that actually suggested that first trailer sort of hinted that Doctor Strange might be the villain of this movie.
Is that what you got out of that?
Well, that's what they were hoping we'd get out of it.
Oh, well.
There was so much stuff they were trying to keep hidden for those folks who were going to go on opening weekend. So that seemed the safest course. You know, Stephen Strange, he's a mean guy. He's beating up Peter Parker. But evidently, the promotional campaign paid off. The news coming out of the trades is 18 to 34-year-olds, the most coveted audience segment by exhibitors because they have the most disposable income. So these are the folks who go up to the concession stand and $7 soda, please, and a $10 popcorn. They do that without even thinking. And if they like a film, pre-pandemic, this was the audience that would go back time and time again. I think it's going to be interesting to see if that is in fact the case.
From the sounds, from the reviews of, there's just so much, it's so densely packed with good material. I wonder if there's a lot of blink and you'll miss it type of moments that would encourage you to go back of, I got to see that one thing again because it was so brief, so quick, but it was so cool. Similar to Ready Player One.
Yes.
You know, where there's like 1,000 little Easter eggs that you could pick up on of different franchise characters and whatnot. Not that we're expecting different franchise characters in the Spider-Man movie at all, but that densely packed, I got to see again to catch these cool little moments.
To be honest, you're not wrong. You know, the folks at Marvel and Disney and Sony, especially Disney, because remember, this is the first time they were allowed to put a good chunk of money into a Spider-Man movie with the hope that they would then get their back end. But everybody's kind of hoping that this will be the first film released in the global pandemic that will do $1 billion worth of ticket sales worldwide. Now, I face it, Shang-Chi wasn't able to do that, and that had a freshest rating of 91%. It had an audience rating of 98%. Which normally should have translated in huge ticket sales, but Shang-Chi struggled to pull in $224 million domestically, and it sold an additional $207 million of tickets overseas for a box office total of $432.
I think it missing out on the Chinese market hurt it in a significant way, because it's the first Chinese superhero we've got on screen, and China says, hard pass, no thanks.
Yeah, you are not wrong there. In fact, to compare and contrast, of the top 5 box office films this year so far, 4 of them are Marvel. But the one that really blew the doors off, and largely, again, because it could go into the Chinese market, was F9, the Fast Saga. That only did $173 million here in North America, but it managed to do $553 million overseas, and that was largely because it could get into China.
I like that it's F9. They just gave up on the whole Fast and Furious thing. It'd be like if the new Spider-Man movie, Spider-Man 5, was just Spidey, the next one.
It's going to be interesting to see if we'll get to what Amy Pascal said about the possible new trilogy in the second half of today's show.
She's just laughing, rolling in a pile of money. That's all that's happening right now with Amy Pascal.
Not necessarily, but again, we'll get to that. But speaking of somebody who's probably at home rolling in a large pile of money, Scarlett Johansson settled her multi-million dollar lawsuit with the Mouse House just recently, and to prove that there are absolutely no hard feelings, at least as far as Marvel Studios is concerned, Scarlett was just named the producer of several upcoming Marvel projects, by the way, none of which have been named or shared or anything. That's all in the Marvel vault. And when asked by Collider if it was weird to be going back to work at Marvel after suing Disney, Johansson replied, as far as Marvel goes, it's like working with family there. I've worked for 10 years now with these guys, so I've got creative shorthand with them. And besides, Marvel has some of the best, very best IP there. And if you work there, you're encouraged to dream big. Nothing's ever off the table, and you can throw all these blue sky ideas around and see what sticks. So when you got a studio like that, a creative playground that's just a dream, why wouldn't you go back to work? Which, I have to tell you, Aaron, I got so many notes about how you kind of nailed the way celebrities talk on Colbert or Fallon or, just sort of like you were doing a great job of channeling this is what my publicist told me to say.
I will say all of the play adjectives praising all of the people that I work with, and I will say absolutely nothing about the project I'm working on because it's so very top secret, I'll get fired. Because that's what pleasant people do when they work together, is they threaten your job with termination if you say the wrong thing. Smile, smile, blink, blink, ding!
Well, but this is what I kind of like about Samu Lee, the gentleman who played the title role in Shang-Chi. He's still not quite polished yet. So when he talks, you get a little more truth. So he was out doing publicity for the Blu-ray of Shang-Chi and the Legend of the Ten Rings, which, by the way, hit store shelves back on November 12th. And he was asked by comicbook.com about his thoughts about the recently announced Shang-Chi sequel. And to be honest, it was kind of a refreshing take. It's like, I guess I wasn't the most surprised given everything that had happened, but I'm just relieved to hear that Destin Daniel Crichton is confirmed to come back. Again, not a surprise, but it's just so good to hear the engine turning and like, great, great, great. We get to tell more story and more delve into the characters and hopefully provide some more badass fight sequences. So just the fact that, we all kind of knew what was coming, But it's just nice that, okay, we got the same director back. But the other thing that's been kind of interesting, a lot of stories now are beginning to leak out about how Marvel actually took advantage of the pandemic, at least when it came to Shang-Chi, and how this film was initially supposed to come out February 12th of this year, which would have been the first day of the Chinese New Year, which Aaron plugs in totally with what you were just saying about how Marvel really wanted this movie to come out and be big in the Chinese market. But if you think about it, this Marvel Studios release actually had three different release dates. It had February 12th, May 7th, July 9th, before finally locking in the September 3rd date. And during that time period, Shang-Chi was test screened. And Destin Daniel Crichton convinced Kevin Feige that there were two aspects of Legend of the Ten Rings that needed to be changed and that they should use this time to their advantage. And one of them was, and this, I'm going to have to go back and watch the film now, because they talk about the flashbacks that accompany Wen Wu's death, the Mandarin. Mm-hmm. Destin explained to The Hollywood Reporter, we weren't totally getting into Wen Wu's head like we wanted to. The idea was these flashbacks came late in the game. When we put them in and showed them to Kevin and the team and then did a test, finally people were feeling the emotions that we wanted them to feel in that part of the film. The other part, and this is kind of surprising, the mid-credit scene with Mark Ruffalo as Bruce Banner and Brie Larson as Carol Danvers was conceived and then shot in early 2021, which meant if they had stuck with their February 12th release date, this wouldn't have happened. Those characters wouldn't have been there. And supposedly Banner and Danvers were both deliberately chosen because those characters represent the science and space side of the MCU. Mm-hmm. And their appearances in Shang-Chi line up supposedly accurately with other events that are happening in the MCU around this exact same time, which to me says this is stuff that we're going to learn about in future films in Phase 4. Does that sound correct to you? Or
if it's happening at this exact same time, I don't know. I mean, Marvel is starting to get really good with their flashback material, mm-hmm, of first year and present day, and then we take you back to another moment in the MCU history. Mm-hmm. So if they handle it through a flashback, yeah, I could see that. Mm-hmm. But I don't see them doing... I'm more thinking if they did a World War Hulk storyline somehow still, because that is Banner also being, you know, cosmic and out in space. Although we already got part of it in Thor Ragnarok where he did his thing on Sakaar, but we still hadn't gotten, he was in the comics, he was banished. And we've spoken about this before, by the Illuminati, which was Tony Stark and Professor Xavier and all the smart people of the Marvel Universe.
Namor.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. And then Hulk came back to get his revenge because his wife died with a, and I think she was pregnant at the time or whatever. But anyway, the comic story no longer lines up in any way with what we could get with the MCU. However, space and science and having Danvers and Banner still could lead to, because we have She-Hulk coming up, and we know that we've got Bruce Banner involved in that storyline somehow, because Mark Ruffalo is already cast for that. So I could see something like that maybe, but yeah, I mean, there's so many different things that they could do. When we end up talking about Hawkeye, we'll end up talking about some things I did not expect to see.
Yes, yes, yes.
But involves some flashback material, much like we're talking about now. So
That we did. Okay, and just a couple of other neat stories associated with the production of Shang-Chi. Kevin Feige, evidently while he was at the premiere of Spider-Man No Way Home, got actually asked about Shang-Chi. He was talking with The Hollywood Reporter about the opening of that film, where the characters are speaking Mandarin and they have English subtitles under them. And you know, remember, we talked earlier about they were doing the test screenings, and evidently Kevin talked with The Hollywood Reporter about, we were always ready for the audiences to reject this in our test screens. But Destin, the director of the film, very much believed the audience would go with it. And sure enough, they did. It wasn't even a question. It wasn't even a concern. On the contrary, I think it actually added to the authenticity, given that this was the way the movie started. And which, by the way, this comment dovetails nicely into something Samu said just this past week when he spoke at the 19th annual Unforgettable Gala, where this young actor received a Breakout in Film honor. And it almost sounded like Samu was talking about Destin when he said, there are so many people who are fighting the good fight, showing me what it means to be unapologetically Asian. The more I think about it, the more it feels like a superpower. Again, circling back to Shang-Chi's director, Destin Daniel Crichton. Now that he's been officially signed to write and direct the sequel, a Collider asked for a status report on this highly anticipated follow-up, and Crichton had flat out admitted, like, I've done zero work today.
You know, Good for him, I gotta say, yeah.
Yeah, you know, but he wanted to say, actually a fun place to be, but that, I mean, everything's a possibility. We're just tossing around very loose ideas at this moment, and hopefully we'll eventually start to hone in on something. But when pushed for specifics, Destin went on to say, there's a lot of ideas that we had in the opener, and some of those ideas have planted as questions at the end of our movie, and there are things we could potentially explore in the future, but everything changes so much. So it's hard to say how many of these ideas will actually make it to the finish line. Just so many there. And where Shang-Chi ends up and who he winds up battling with in this sequel, if we're being completely honest here, Aaron, it honestly kind of depends on where the MCU is at that point, whether we're still in phase 4 or phase 5, and what's being set up and needs to be paid off from an earlier film or a limited series, which brings us to what got revealed in the end credit scenes of Spider-Man No Way Home. Likewise, I think what you just referred to in regard to episode 5 of Hawkeye. So we'll be back in a moment, folks. But again, I want to warn you, there will be spoilers, limited spoilers, but spoilers even so. So you've been warned.
With Kizik Hands Free Shoes, motion sounds something like this. Kizik helps you experience the magic of motion. With over 200 patents and easy on, easy off technology, you'll never have to touch your shoes again. There are hundreds of styles and colors, plus a squish like nothing you've ever felt. For a limited time, get a free pair of socks with your first order at kizik.com/socks.
Before we get to talking about Spider-Man No Way Home and episode 5 of Hawkeye, we've talked a little bit today about the impact that the pandemic has had on the MCU. And there was a story over this past weekend, Aaron, that I'm pretty sure that you saw, the one about Letitia Wright.
Yep, I saw that and sadly disappointed.
A couple of things here, folks. We finally actually have some details about what happened to Letitia in that accident that happened in Worcester, Massachusetts back in July. Turns out, pretty severe injuries. Letitia ended up with a fractured shoulder and also a concussion with some pretty severe side effects. So that's the story about her being sent home to recuperate and how Ryan Coogler was going to shoot around her and hopefully that she'd be able to return to the set. And evidently her recovery was taking longer than expected. So the production of Black Panther 2 Wakanda Forever was put on pause in November with the idea that they would all regroup in early 2022 and finally shoot Letitia's scenes. The story that Aaron is referring to that is somewhat disappointing is that there's a rumor making the rounds that Letitia Wright, who has put out some comments about vaccines and that sort of thing on social media in the past, evidently, as of November 20th, she is still unvaccinated. And the problem is that the Walt Disney Company has issued a mandate that if you are going on the set of either a TV show or a movie that the Walt Disney production or company is involved in, you need to be vaccinated.
I'm going to borrow a Jim-ism and say the supreme irony, which, by the way, supreme irony is just regular irony with sour cream and tomatoes added to it. So that's a Taco Bell joke out there. Anyway, the supreme irony of this instance is if COVID broke out inside the MCU, she'd be the one, her character would be the one coming up with the vaccine to cure the world. And here it is, she can't take it. So now, her beliefs aside, it creates an issue. If she's out, what happens to Black Panther 2? Do you recast Shuri and reshoot everything? I mean, and then how much would need to be redone? Because they've shot just about everything. Then, unfortunately, she was injured quite severely, and there's no joking matter about that. But then there's more left that they're waiting to shoot with her. So how much would need to be redone? And how much of the other cast members are involved in those reshoots? It's not just her.
No.
Right? It could be, you know, what if it's a big battle scene and all of the girls are out on the battlefield? You know, that gets really expensive if you've got 500 extras. So you've got that to think about. Like, if you're going to think about reshooting, you've got to think about what you need to reshoot and what that's going to cost you financially, because that changes the entire equation of your movie. And what about the idea of shelving it indefinitely? Is that where we're at right now, where it's just so complicated that they just say, you know what, put it on the shelf and we'll deal with it later?
You ask a lot of very interesting questions there that I can't even pretend to have answers to. What I can tell you is I don't see a whole lot of wiggle room here. I don't know if you've been following the Ingo Rademacher story, a longtime actor who'd been on General Hospital at ABC.
He left for not getting vaccinated, right?
Likewise, Steve Burton.
I mean, do we have a healthcare worker hide in a dark alley and give them the jab without them consenting? It's a vaccine run.
I don't know what to tell you there. I mean, I was just talking with folks this weekend where, for example, there is the ESPN employee, longtime ESPN employee, much beloved there, you know, a very valued performer. But the thing is that she and her husband have been doing in vitro fertilization. And her fear was they're spending all of this money to try to have a child. And, you know, they went to their doctor and it's like, can you tell me that this vaccination isn't going to impact what we're trying to do here? And the doctor's like, I don't know what to tell you. We don't have any science to back that up. And, you know, she went to her boss's idiot band. And in the end, it's like, look, I'm really sorry. We obviously want to hang on to you, but this is what Disney is saying.
Well, I mean, when you make a blanket rule for the company, you can't have a special exception, because then you have 1,000 different special exceptions come up.
There we go.
About, and I mean, it's unfortunate. I mean, it's all unfortunate. And the thing is, we like Letitia as an actress, and I think that Black Panther is a very important character for the Black community to have that role model out there, and I would hate the idea for him to just disappear and go away. And, you know, at first, the idea of recasting T'Challa seemed just blasphemous. But the reality of, you know, time healing all wounds, as a cliched phrase that gets overused, but, you know, time has passed. And the sting will not be as sharp to see a new face put in that role. But I would hate for the idea of the character to just entirely disappear. And then to not have the sister, you know, she was a very important part of that family dynamic. If you've got to recast them, if you got to recast one, just recast them both. You know what? The next time they show up, which could be 2 or 3 years down the road, maybe Peter Parker will go, T'Challa, is that you? Gosh, I almost didn't recognize you. It's been so long. And just leave it at that.
It's so funny you talk about recasting, because think about it. In fact, I think HBO Max, it may be this weekend. They actually do there's a special about the 20th anniversary of the Harry Potter film franchise. And think about how Richard Harris as Dumbledore just did such a wonderful job for the first two films of that series. And then, of course, we lost him tragically. And Michael Gambon had the somewhat difficult job of stepping in and filling that role. And that film series didn't even break stride. I mean, it was a very different take on Dumbledore, but it still worked. And that film series, to this day, I mean, you know, we're 25 films into the MCU at this point, but those 8 Harry Potter films, I think, you know, work beautifully as a series. And the fact that so many of those actors stayed with the film series all the way through. So,
yeah. Well, we've got a new roadie. We've got a new banner from what we started with. So recasting is not a non-starter for Disney or for Marvel in this case. It's a real possibility. And, I thought it was very kind and generous of them to even consider the thought of not recasting T'Challa. Usually it's, about what makes sense money-wise, not what makes sense heart-wise. So the fact that they were that considerate of everyone loved Chadwick, let's not touch that, was nice. But like I said, time heals all wounds. Time is moving on. The idea of recasting doesn't seem quite as blasphemous right now. And if Letitia has become an issue where she can't be a part of the movie and you do have to recast her, go ahead and recast it and then rewrite the damn thing and just start over. Because you're not, you don't have the same constraints anymore if you do recast.
I get that. I do. I so enjoyed her performance as Shuri. And again, when you watch Endgame, and in fact, you were just talking on the last show about On Your Right, and that moment when the three of them come striding out of that portal, the sound that an audience made was just amazing. So, all right. Well, speaking of people making happy noises, I have to say today when I was watching episode 5 of Hawkeye, this show just keeps getting better and better. In fact, do you want to talk about Marvel's use of flashbacks? And can you talk a little bit about how episode 5 kicked off?
Yeah, this is going to take a minute. It's like I went on a worldwide trip and stole everything from all of the hotels because, Jim, there's just so much to unpack.
Okay.
Starting off with, I love the first moments when we were connected to the Black Widow storyline of freeing the widows. Didn't expect that for the opening scene of the Hawkeye show. And then we've seen people get dusted and we've seen people come back from the blip. But this is the first time that we've seen someone from kind of their own perspective of being blinked out and brought back again. It's an instant thing. And then the room changed around her. And that was kind of a neat little effect. But when she was going to splash water on her face and she turned to dust, I was like, oh my goodness. And then she came right back and I was like, double, oh my goodness. What's going on?
Yeah.
It was wonderful.
Well, first of all, Elizabeth Pugh's work in Black Widow is one of my favorite aspects of this film. And to see her just continue the same fascinating character. In fact, as much as I enjoyed the opening, the girls' night.
Yes. In mac and cheese with the ladies.
Yes. Yes.
Now, I'll tell you, that dialogue could have been clunky and stilted and horrible. But those two girls give it their all and make it entertaining. And even though it's an exposition dump, it's a fun one because of the interaction of the two girls and how their characters play with one another. It was a really good scene.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And it's one of the things we've been hearing about possible future use of Kate and Yelena in, is it the Young Avengers? Is that?
Yeah.
Okay.
And boy, that would be a wonderful team up to have them be like the Falcon and Winter Soldier, just, the girls on a mission. I think that would be a heck of a lot of fun. I don't know if you caught during the mac and cheese girls night. Did you catch Yelena talking about, is my first time in New York? I want to go check out the new improved Statue of Liberty.
Yes, yes. All right. And again, I'm so glad you pointed it out because are you assuming the same thing I'm assuming that is
the reference to Spider-Man? When we get that scene? Yeah, it has to be. I mean, the thing is, the amount of time that it takes to write a show and shoot a show and then get the thing on the air and same thing with films years ahead. But the fact that Spidey is coming out in like hours from this episode landing, the timing and the thoughtfulness to get that little thread to connect so well. That's impressive.
I agree. But at the same time, there was that lovely moment of Clint in the city and the fact that New York has supposedly put up a plaque honoring the place where the Avengers first assembled. And that was cool, but I also really enjoyed his talk with Natasha at that moment about what he had to do.
Right.
It was good scene after good scene after good scene. I mean, even just the scene where Kate went home to her mom and was vulnerable and sad, and we've been watching these two struggle to reach out to one another. And then to lead up to that great action scene in the parking lot at night, though I have to say the lead up to that, where the two tracksuit guys were in the car talking about, are we liking the Royal Tannenbaums?
Yep.
You know, it's like, it's kind of a deep cut, but I really liked it.
It does. I a couple of things. I like that Linda Cardellini has yet to be the girl, quote unquote, that Clint has to go save or chase after. Like, anytime there's a hero, he's always got to tell me where the girl is.
Yeah.
I got to save the girl. And like, they lose their identity and just become the girl, the object that you have to chase. And Linda Cardellini is more like his moral compass. Like, he's like, I don't know what to do. I gotta do this thing. And she's like, you don't need my permission. You go do your job. But she's important to Clint.
No, absolutely. Absolutely.
But never the MacGuffin that he has to chase after or protect. She's got her own identity, which is nice.
She's smart, she's tough. I mean, you know, that what's interesting with Hawkeye is you have learned why these two would have connected. It's not just, you know, this is my wife and I live in the country with my kids. It's like, this is my partner. This is a woman I respect and I value her counsel. And, you know, I mean, that's all killer.
Yeah.
Speaking of which, though, let's talk about how after the battle in the parking lot, we have that, you know, American Sign Language with dialogue conversation between Clint and Maya. And do you think we're seeing the turn here for Echo? Or
it almost looks like Echo, the series, is going to be Maya hunting down the plot and the people behind her father's murder. Mm-hmm. You know, if it wasn't really Ronan, then who was it and why? And that could be like the thrust of her storyline for her first season, which is more really how we get to know her. I mean, we don't know much of her moral compass outside of she's out for revenge at the moment. And there's actually a really great series on Netflix right now called Voir, V-O-I-R, directed by David Fincher.
Oh, wow.
And one of the episodes is about not necessarily needing to like your protagonist. And like Lawrence of Arabia, he kind of realized that the way for him to be a leader was he had to be unlikable to make the hard decisions. And that revenge is totally acceptable. I mean, it's a dirty, ugly thing to take someone else's life. And so we as the audience are like, oh, no, I would never kill. But revenge, if someone murdered your wife, oh, you would feel that rage and that desire to exact your revenge on that person. So in the fantasy of film, this is an acceptable storyline to create the hero's motive to go commit murder, which is otherwise unacceptable and would negate their hero-ness. If they just went out and murdered, well, you're a bad guy. So it was a really great look at revenge as a tactic. And I kind of think that's where Echo is going, is she's on a revenge plot. And because we need her as a good guy, it has to be a revenge plot. And so, yeah, I think that's where the series is headed, unless for some unexpected reason, they tie all of that up in the very last episode of Hawkeye, which I think would take a heck of a lot of screen time to tell that entire tale.
Got it. But I have to say, I'm sitting here watching this with Nancy, and they get to that final shot of, you know, on Kate's cell phone. And it's one of these things where it's like, your voice just rang in my ear about, you know, so what's it going to be at the end? This is going to be like the one shot, you know, then it goes to blackout. It's like, wow. So they had Aaron in the room helping them with the script. That's pretty impressive.
It sucks to be correct sometimes. It seems like Kate's mom is more of a baddie than the swordsman. Is that our misdirect for the entire season? Was we thought the swordsman was going to have a clink, clink, clink sword play with Kate, and it turns out mom was the one that was behind all of this mess right now? That's an interesting turn.
That is an interesting turn.
But the most important question out of the entire series right now, and you skipped over the most important thing, Jim. I'm ashamed of you. Clint going to don the costume made by the LARPers? That's what I want to know right now. Do we get Clint in costume?
And it's interesting you bring up the LARPer because Grills.
Yeah.
You know, one of the things I have to admit I've been enjoying about Hawkeye is Grills and the LARPers would be so easy to do as comic relief. Just, you know, a one-note thing. And the fact that they turn out to be complex and supportive and helpful. It's kind of like, do you remember, do you ever see Galaxy Quest?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Remember how they introduced the fans of the show and they're obsessive nerdy kids who are, you know, in episode 4 and that sort of thing. But they turn out to be a key component of the crew that Galaxy Quest actually succeeding. In fact, that there's that wonderful moment where they're bringing the ship in and the kids are actually standing in the parking lot with the fireworks to bring the ship in. The fact that what could have been a one-note gag character got complex and deep and redeemed, you know, and somebody the audience could get behind. That's one of the reasons I've so enjoyed Hawkeye is that with the luxury of these 6 episodes, as opposed to trying to tell the story in just 2 hours of screen time.
Yeah.
It's just been a pleasure all the way around the building.
That was another thing I wanted to bring up and kind of ask you about when you are such a fan of structure. Film versus television. If you do a film, it's usually the traditional 3-act play, right? Opening, mid, and then big climax at the end. For TV, you have to have a cliffhanger every hour for like 9 hours. Because you gotta have a reason to tune in next week. Like every soap opera is like, Donna, what are you doing with my brother? It's like there's always a thing that keeps you coming back for more. So when it comes to, like Kingpin is the perfect example. What are we tuning in for next week? Well, geez, man, you just showed me a picture of the Kingpin. Of course I'm tuning in next week. So you don't really need the same 3-act structure as film.
You don't.
When you get to our MCU characters, and this is something that we can talk about over the course of shows in the future, but is there a character that you would rather see ditch the 3-act structure and go to the small screen because you have different storytelling structure? Like right now, we're talking about the luxury of letting the character breathe to have these moments that we wouldn't get in a film simply because of the fact that we have more time. But the fact that we're now ditching structure as well along the way and doing something different than you would do in a film also is a huge improvement, I think, on your storytelling capability. In much the same way the comic books were when I read them as a kid, because they continued from month to month and they told the story arc over 3 months. I had a reason to give you my $1.50 every month or every week or whatever. What are your thoughts on film versus TV, the benefits and the cons?
Oh, no. It's been, in fact, think about it. That lovely scene with Kate and Yelena. I mean, in fact, based on that scene alone, I would sign up today. I'd go another 3-year run with Disney Plus for The Young Adventures to see those two together. Because, again, that was a lovely scene that was comical, but then turned serious, and as you mentioned, it was an exposition dump, but it was an entertaining exposition dump, and we got humor, but then it got serious, and then the question of, well, he's a monster, look what he did, and Kate trying to explain, you know, somebody who's a superhero, you know, or an Avenger has to do this sort of thing, and, you know, and Elena's like, and how long have you known this guy? Well, a week. Just good writing coupled with good acting and two people who are very comfortable in their characters. And it's just sort of, I mean, face it, what's intriguing about television, and it's kind of ironic because some of the characters that we love on television, like House or Monk or that sort of thing, don't necessarily make us comfortable. But it is also about you're comfortable enough to invite this person into your house every week.
Like Dexter pushed the limits of that one, right? You know, it's like, here's a serial killer, but wait, he's a good guy. He's a good serial killer. You're like, well, okay, one more episode.
There you go. You know, but again, a serial killer who kills serial killers. It was like, okay. So
a couple of things before we switch subjects. In the opening scene, I had to actually compare vests that Yelena was wearing versus the one in Hawkeye versus the one in Black Widow versus the one that Scarlet wears in Infinity War. Mm-hmm. Do you know where I'm going with this? It was going to break the timeline. I was so frantic about this. In Black Widow, there's a scene where Scarlet and Yelena are riding around in a car, and she's like, I got this new vest. It's got so many pockets. You can put so many things in it. You remember that scene?
Yes, I remember that.
Like, oh, I knew you'd like my vest. This is so cool. It's kick-ass. Anyway, she ends up giving that vest to Scarlet, and Scarlet ends up wearing the vest in Infinity War. And so they retcon that one. The vest that Scarlet wore in Infinity War, they gave to Yelena, so she was the originator of the vest. So that way, when you go back and watch Infinity War, you go, oh, wow, look at that. It's a sisterly love thing. Who knew? Well, anyway, in the beginning of Hawkeye, she's wearing a vest, a black vest, and then she gets dusted away, and then she comes back, which means that Scarlet had to have come and gone by that point and is now dead. And if that were the case, she's not wearing the right vest. And so I had to do a vest comparison, a forensic analysis of the vest, and we've come back with... it's a different vest, Jim. It's no big deal. Everyone can settle down.
I was about to say the irony that you do this on the day that they dumped 1,500 documents for the JFK assassination. You know, that's like,
right. Yeah.
You know, think about the conspiracy theorist folks who were miles deep in that stuff, and you're doing vest comparison. But
I do the important work, Jim. I do the important work only.
There we go. There we go. Okay. Well, now to pivot to the film that I, again, want to stress, neither of us have seen at this point, Spider-Man No Way Home, and largely positive reviews. In fact, a number of people have talked about, they were surprised about how emotional it was, that this is a film that basically tries to do the impossible. It brings all three variations of the Spider-Man film franchise together and tries to bring them together in a satisfying way and supposedly largely succeeds. You know, the only complaint I've really seen out there about this one, Aaron, is that people the effect, look, Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse already did the multiverse thing in a visually stunning way. And in fact, I think you were pointing out on our last show with the now two sequels that are coming our way. We've got the Across the Spider-Verse Part 1. And how they can, if what the filmmakers are saying are true, it's every one of the multiverses will have a distinctly different visual style.
Sony just found a money printing machine, and they just hit the on button and they've walked away. And it's just going to keep spitting it out year after year. And that's fine. As long as it stays good, fine.
Well, and now speaking of which, though, that Sony and its money making machine, the two end credit scenes here tie directly in, one with Venom. In fact, it kind of picks up where Venom Let There Be Carnage's end credit scene picked up. Then we, of course, get what you and I both think really is the first trailer for Multiverse of Madness, right?
I mean, it's cut like a trailer, and that's fine. If they add more to it or give us another alternate version later on, that's fine as well. But usually, like in the case of Venom, it was a scene. A singular scene where he was at a bar trying to figure out about this world of superheroes that he's now inhabiting. And the Doctor Strange thing was like 20 scenes cut together really fast, which is a heck of a lot more like a trailer than a scene. So yeah, I would definitely call the Doctor Strange Multiverse of Madness trailer as the second end credit clip that we'll get at the end of Spider-Man.
You have seen this. I have not. I have read descriptions of it. But this appears to be the first MCU film that now ties directly in with a limited series. In fact, we've got Doctor Strange talking with Wanda, and she supposedly tries to explain what went on in Westview, New Jersey, and Strange doesn't care. He just wants to know what she knows about the multiverse. But what do you make of what appears to be a direct tie-in with the Marvel What If animated series?
I don't think that's that.
Okay.
I think that we've got enough multiverse madness in the live action MCU via the Spider-Man movie that's coming out and by what Wanda has done and or will do in the future, and Kang and Loki. I think we've got enough multiverse that we don't need to go all to the what if universe as well and say that, because I mean that Doctor Strange, the Dark Sorcerer Supreme came from the comics, so it could just be that they're going back to the source, the well of inspiration, which was the comics, and they're giving us a Dark Sorcerer Supreme. What I have learned from this is how to handle a mirror universe situation if your character already has a goatee. See, normally, I'm going to give you a quick primer. If you were a good guy and you're clean shaven and you end up in a mirror universe where you meet the bad version of you, the bad version of you has a goatee. Ah, but what if the good version of you already has a goatee? The answer to that, Jim, is the mean, ugly, nasty version of you has a longer goatee, and that's it.
Wow.
He does change his voice on the read of the line. It is a little bit different than the Doctor Strange that we're familiar with. And I don't quite know. I have not yet formed my opinion on that voice of that character yet.
Okay.
But we still have time. And who knows? It may end up getting changed. It may be just a shot in the thing, but so we had is it Baron Mordo, who was one of the main characters of the first Doctor Strange, and at the end credit scene of that movie, they did a setup like he was going to end up being the bad guy for the sequel, and
I am happy
that they do bring him back. And it's about the fact that during the Spider-Man movie, Doctor Strange cast the spell and all this chaos was unleashed as a result. And so in this trailer, they say that he must pay for his insolence or whatever for casting the spell in the first place. And then you get Baron Mordo, who says, "The biggest threat to our universe is you, Doctor Strange." And that's then when we get the glimpse of the Dark Sorcerer Supreme. And he says his line about, "Things happened," and then we get our regular good guy version of Doctor Strange, who has this very puzzled look on his face like, oh, what did I just do?
Okay. All right. I have to now go whack-a-mole. I got to find this thing. I'm not going to get to see this movie till probably Tuesday of next week. I mean, tickets are sold out. You know, Nancy and I will, you know, not be able to get to a matinee till then. But I mean, and let's be honest, we did know some of this was coming because the giant tentacle monster thing, we had that Lego set that came out, you know, or the image of the Doctor Strange Lego set that came out. So we kind of knew this was coming. But to sort of close things out, I got to say that based on episode 5 of, you know, Hawkeye, and likewise what people are saying about Spider-Man No Way Home, and it really sounds like the MCU is firing on all cylinders.
Yeah.
Very happy that if Marvel Studios continues to chug along like this. That said, one disturbing bit of news came out of the world premiere of Spider-Man in Hollywood. We were talking at the top of the show about Amy Pascal. She got asked by Variety to follow up on her announcement about, oh, we've got another trilogy planned, and you know it's going to be with Tom Holland, and our association with the Marvel Studios is going to continue. And so Variety asked for specifics about this, and she appeared to walk her comments back. You know, in fact,
she had to bend over because apparently she was talking out her ass.
She was quite the ventriloquist. But yes, that she said things to the effect of, if it were up to her, Sony and Marvel Studios partnership would move forward. So kind of concerning, especially given, I guess, the way Spider-Man No Way Home leaves off, you know, sort of teeing up an interesting place for Peter Parker to be. But I can't leave you there, folks. I got to leave you on a happier note. So this is news coming out of Walt Disney World. Earlier this week on Twitter, there was a photo posted of a very happy set of Imagineers and construction people standing in front of Guardians of the Galaxy Cosmic Rewind. And what they revealed along with this photo is that these folks had just been on a test ride of this new indoor thrill ride with its storytelling coaster. Now, mind you, I've been told the track is up and running and the vehicles are up and running. A lot of the media isn't necessarily in place yet, but the ride system evidently works beautifully and they're ridiculously happy with it. And they're very much looking forward to bringing this online in 2022. So something else for us to look forward to in the new year. Okay, that's going to do it for this week, folks. Aaron, as always, great fun following you on social media. In fact, I was enjoying, is it the mandolin or the ukulele you were talking about?
The mandolin, its tuning is upside down from a guitar. I was just at a store a couple of weeks ago and was about to buy a mandolin, and I ended up getting talked out of it because of the upside down tuning, and then I just ended up buying another acoustic guitar.
Wow. Okay.
Much to the chagrin of my wife, but yeah.
Well, seriously, folks, Aaron on social media isn't just entertaining. You learn things. So, yep. Aaron, if folks want to follow you on social media, how would they go about doing that?
Well, since I'll be in a theater watching Spider-Man very shortly, the best way to do it, if you want to follow me, is go on Fandango and buy one ticket. I'll be in Theater 13 watching in 3D. So if you actually see me with your own two eyes, I will be in 3D. If you do it in the 2D theater, I'll be in 2D at Azaprod.
On the other hand, if you're looking for us on social media, you can find us on Twitter and Instagram as Jim Hill Media, and on Facebook as Jim Hill Media News. Beyond that, folks, if you could do Aaron and I a favor, if you could head over to Apple Podcasts and rate and recommend the show you're listening to now, Marvelous Disney, that would be helpful. If you want to head over to Bandcamp and subscribe, well, that's how Aaron and I can actually afford copies of Alex Ross's new book, so which I'm going to go order now. But anyway, thanks for listening, folks, and we will be back soon.